This conversation with Frank Brocchi took place at his home in Troy on January 7th, 1976. The interviewer is Sam Schrager.
That I really struck me when I was reading that was when you talked about honesty and learning when you were a kid from church and from your parents, and I couldn't help but wonder how you learned in those days when you were a kid to be honest.
You weren't. It was no effort. In other words, they didn't go out of their way, but to see that you were honest. But if you made a mistake and were dishonest, that's when the roof fell in. See, the fact that you were taught you weren't taught to be honest, as you were definitely taught not to be dishonest. See, that would if there was no such thing as having money in your pocket, and if you did, you had to have a pretty good answer of where it came from. Now that opened up your case, and you were just you had to reconcile what if you did pick it up and took it here or there, and of course you went to a store. You weren't allowed to touch things. You weren't allowed to grab a candy bar or anything like that. It was just prohibitive, and you wouldn't think of it. It didn't enter your mind. And yet, as I grew up, and by the time I was a junior in high school, I saw other kids stealing, and to me, it was shocking. Yet I didn't squeal on them. It was known; their reputations were known among people. When I was a senior, and before I got into the bank, during the summer that I was a junior, and after school I would walk into the merchandise store down in Kendrick, and he would be busy, and he'd say, "Frank, you watch the store. I've got to sweep, or I've got to go up to the post office, and I got to do things. So you watch it." And of course, kids would come in, and they knew me, that I wasn't a squealer, I guess, and they would steal collars. You remember, they had attached collar at that time. It was a soft collar, but it was attached. Well, they would reach up in the counter or up on the shelves and steal those things right in my presence. Yet I was there to take care of it, and I was on the spot, and I didn't know what to do.
What did you do?
I think they were known. They were known to the manager, and as I recall, I told him that they were in there and that they had taken things, but I didn't describe it and I didn't tell him what. Mm-hmm. He said, "Well," he says, "I know it." He says, "There's nothing else to do," and I think he admired me for not squealing. At the same time, I told him enough to know that it had been done, and of course they were watched. All of them were watched, but.
Did you identify the kids?
Oh no, they knew. They knew who.
Kids.
They were probably in there when he left the store in the first place. I recall this one instance. I don't think it was an everyday occurrence, but I can remember definitely that they're the same as said, "Do you keep your mouth shut or else?" See? And of course, I was just a young squirt, and I was pretty timid myself. But we hung around the confectionery. He always stayed open till 10 and 11 at night. And you'd go to basketball practice, and of course after practice, we'd end up there. We never had money in our pocket. The big heroes either had money or they were paper boys, and they always had money. There were stars on the basketball squad, and that was the big game in those days. There was no football, and there was nothing else, no track, but it was basketball, and of course they would. After the basketball practice, they'd sit down and order their sandwiches, but we didn't. And of course, the owner was in the back room or he was up in front, they'd reach into a candy bar. They thought nothing of it, and yet they were heroes. And of course, that thing impressed you. It did me. I thought I wouldn't trade places with them, regardless. It was stealing. You were born. It was in your blood. The not to steal, not to be honest, that was taken for granted. But to steal, that's something you had to practice and you had to do. And if you didn't do it, then you were naturally honest. Now that's backwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's the way it is. That's the way it was in my town.
I can't help but wonder what it was that you got from your family that was different than what they got from their families, or whether they got the same thing and didn't listen.
They were rare. In other words, you could pick out the 25 boys or the 50 boys that was in high school, and I dare say there was not over maybe 10 of them that was, with us, it was sticky-fingered, as we'd call it. The majority, by far, we were all under the same class, especially we that lived in the country and were the timid type or the backward type. It was the heroes in town that were skilled. They could play marbles and steel. We all looked up to them. It was that way. I'll never forget when I got this job in the bank. It was during Christmas vacation, and of course that was right in the midst of basketball. And I was a senior, and I was on the team. But I was not an outstanding ball player. But I held my job, and I played, and I went for the team all during my junior year, and I started during my senior year, and we were playing. And when I got this job, when I could come down and work at the bank at 3 o'clock, the minute school was out, and that's when they practiced basketball, I said, "No, I'm through. I'm not going to play basketball anymore. I'm quitting." And so that night, I sent the word out. That must have been after school took up, after January 2nd, because I rushed down to the bank and did my job, and I took the mail up to the post office. And as I was on the way up, boy, here three basketball players stepped out of the behind the of a little entrance, and they stopped me. They said, "I understand you're quitting basketball." And I said, "Yeah, I got a job." And I said, "That's what I'm going to do." And they wanted to give me a licking over that. They was going to, just because. And I had made remarks that, well, I didn't enjoy it anyway anymore. That the coach wasn't the best, and we had two or three players that was running the whole team. And of course, they knew that they were them, and so they were laying for me, as the fellow said. And I got by. They didn't touch me, but I got a pretty good raking over verbally, and I went on and mailed my letters, and I never went back. And the coach came to me, and he said that he had heard that I was quitting, that I had quit. He tried to get me to change my mind, and he even went so far as to say, "Well, the kids will say you're yellow if you..." I remember that. He said, "They'll say you're yellow if you don't come back." I said, "I don't care what they say. This is my life, and this is what I want, and I can't do both. I can't come work at this bank and practice basketball, and this is what I'm working for." He understood it. He was trying to bluff me, obviously, because I couldn't get any connection of why I would be yellow because I dropped basketball to go work in a bank after hours.
It sounds like you must have been shooting for your own goals in a different way than most kids.
It was a thrill. It was something you never heard of. The first place to go into a bank, a local youngster to go into a bank in those days, I'm telling you, you looked up to the banker. He sat up on the pedestal. Yes, he was powerful, had power, and of course the fact that you could be picked out of a community the size of Kendrick, taken into a bank, and given all these privileges just because you had a good reputation. Your parents, I should say, your background from the parents was good. They knew. Otherwise, it wouldn't be granted to you. Others tried it. They tried to get in after I did. I never have heard of one since then, and I never heard of one before that ever got to go into a bank and learn it and walk out when you were through and be your stepping stone. That's all I ever did in my life. Is in a bank, all doing from 1924 till 1974 January. That's 50 years, solid 50 years, and that's all I ever did was banking. I never was on the other side of the counter.
Do you think?
But it was just an opportunity that one lives by. I remember that when I first started. We discussed the fact that should I go to a business school in Spokane and study the banking as they offered it, or should I take bookkeeping? And Mr. Dobenberg, who was the cashier, said, oh, that would be so foolish. Now, you not only can't afford it, your mother would have to pay for it, but you wouldn't do any good. Because what you're going to get here, what you're going to get in this bank will be so practical, it'll be actual experience that you'll gain the rest of your life that you'll never get into in a school. So I was off and running right there.
He said you didn't need to go and no. get any training.
Well, he said the only thing that you could possibly do yourself some good would be commercial law. And he says commercial law is nothing but reasoning right and wrong. Did you ever hear it set up that way or defined as commercial law being what is right and what is wrong? And that is you. That's up to you to decide what is right and what is wrong. If you've got any kind of a mind, if you've got a brain, and experience will tell you, the teachings from experience will tell you what is right and what is wrong. In other words, if you have two people come to you, you're going to be a judge between them. That's commercial law. Is that if a man had a right to take that it was his, and or he didn't pay a bill because he didn't get value received, those are the things that you'll be settling. You won't decide a lawsuit. You won't be a lawyer. You won't be called upon those things, but you will be called upon during your life as a banker to decide in your own mind, as well as John Jones or Harry Jones, is which one is right. You'll be asked, and that's commercial law. And he says experience will give you that right, and that's true too. Because many and many a time, I've been in the middle. That was and the more I drug on in the banking world, the more I became that man in the middle. I would have people come to me and say, "I want to sell my farm. What shall I ask for it?" Okay, the next day. The neighbor would come. I understand Bill has got his farm for sale. How much shall I give him? Here you advise Bill, or you advise Bill what he should ask, and here comes John and say, what should I pay? So what do you do?
And what do you do?
You're a friend to both. You be honest, and you say what you think they should do. You try to tell the seller to ask a fair, honest price. Then you can say to the man, to the neighbor that wants to buy him, yes, I happen to know, and I think it is a fair price. Well, if he says it's too much, that's your business. But that's between you and him. If you feel that $10,000 is too much and you're willing to give $8,000, you go to him. See, I'm not telling you to go, but that's your business. That's how you settle those things. And it works.
You can do that without feeling a conflict
yes,
of interest.
Yes, because you are you, and they probably, if anyone would stop and think, you probably know that I was a part of it. There are things that do get you involved. In other words, many decisions are based upon the fact that if one person comes to me and I make a statement, they use it against me. That happens many times, and many times it happened that I never said anything, yet I was told that I said that, John Jones wants to sell his farm and he wants $25,000. Well, Brocky says that's too much, see. Now, there's where you get in trouble, see. And those things, that's true that those things do happen. And probably I did, and it got to the stage and many times I had no knowledge of it. I had never said anything, but that's a way, because they felt, well, you'll come right down the minute I said that, see. Now, of course, that's boasting, but at the same time, that has happened. And in my school affairs, in my lifetime in the school board, that was a very, very common thing to say, well, Rocky said it. That it should be this way and that way, and I found that more effective than the banking business.
What do you mean more effective?
Well, it was easier. They took advantage of the fact that I had said things as a trustee on the school more than a banker, because I think in your banking circles you're limited to values, and if it was too much, it was too much, and if it wasn't, well, they just whatever. There was somebody else to buy it. If he didn't want to pay the price, well, he could go to somebody else. See, if you were too high. But when you made a statement in the school board to the effect that your son is well, not an angel, in other words, the teacher's right, Brocky said so. See, then you're in trouble because there's no backing away. There's nobody else to go to. Yes, that's great.
Well, let's say you you did say what you thought was a fair price for the farm, and yes. And it was
too much.
Yeah. Well, no. Say you said the farm isn't worth $25,000, and then
that would be my judgment.
Right. Then the guy that was offering the farm comes in and he's mad.
His privilege would be. He wanted $25,000. Well, the guy that came to me said, "Joe wants $25,000 for his farm, and is it worth it?" And I said, "No, that's too much for you to pay." In other words, if for a man, if he had to borrow it, if he was financially in difficulties, and say, for instance, he was paying $25,000 for a farm, and he had only a couple thousand dollars to pay on. And I said, "Yes, grab it, give him your $2,000. To me, that was wrong. Who are you hurting? You were hurting that buyer. He could not afford to pay $25,000. So you have to weigh the facts. And so naturally, I said, "Well, it's too much." Well, he dropped out. And maybe this seller over here said, "Well, if you'd have stayed out of it, he'd have bought it, see." But that's not here nor there. That's my privilege, and that's water under the bridge. But if he wants $25,000 and it is a good buy, he could go to anybody else, and they didn't have to come to me and ask. If they were satisfied, lots of people have judgments and they could make up their own minds. You know, the neighbor is the last one to buy your farm because he always said, "Oh, that's too much." Well, they sell it to the California guy. He comes up here and he pays him twice as much. See, that's history. But that's the last one, that's the last person in the world to buy your farm is your neighbor because he thinks you ask too much.
Was that true in the 20s
that's
and
true.
30s?
Yes, very much
days?
So. Well, more so in the last 20 years, last 10 years, I'd say, because we weren't used to the high prices. There was people came in here from the outside, and they felt it was bargains. They felt it was cheap. To us, it was staggering, and it still is to me. I cannot get used to these high prices. I don't think I ever will. Because I know what values were at one time, and I don't think it's a healthy situation. When they talk about $800 to $1,000 or $1,200 an acre, and that scares you. You know, there used to be a rule that land is worth what it'll produce. See, it don't produce those kind of figures.
What it will produce in how long?
Dollars and cents, yeah, so over a period. I knew people, the old-timers that lived here and bought these farms and paid $5,000 for 160 acres or 320 with maybe 100 acres in cultivation, they took a lifetime to pay for them. When I came to the First Bank of Troy, there was mortgages for $2,500, for $5,000. $5,000 was considered a very high mortgage. But there was a lot of $2,000 and $3,000 mortgages that had never been paid on a single dollar on the principal in a period of the last 10 years previous to when I come. And they were gone on. All they wanted to do was every year they came into the bank, "I would like to pay the renta on my note." Renta meant the interest. And it went on and on and on. Well, after being in the bank and becoming responsible, eventually we put them on a program of paying at least $100 a year on the principal. And working it off that way. I saw a mother, a wife of an old timer, and she was well in her 60s and 70s. At the time she did this, she was milking cows, and she would bring 2 to 3 cream checks every Saturday into the bank. And you would total those up, and they would probably come to say $14.76. She would have 24 cents in change. She'd say, "Here, give me a receipt for $15 and put it on the mortgage." She paid a $2,500 mortgage from those cream checks over a period of, I'd say, around 3 or 4 years. I'll never forget the last payment she made when she picked up the note and walked out. And her husband, I don't think he ever knew. Other than when it was clear, he never inquired what's the balance, or how's the mortgage coming. He never said. He went around. He did his work. He farmed, and she took care of the cows. And every time she had a fresh cow, the payment would go up. some of the payments that get as high as $45, $50 during the summer and the spring when the grass was green and the fresh cow came in and she was getting more cream. Well, the payment got bigger, but that's true.
She came in every week?
Every Saturday, so help me. She made a payment on that mortgage. And here, they had gone on for at least, I would say, 20 years without making a dime's payment on it. It had just been renewed and renewed and renewed. That was the banking history. That was common. Many farmers would renew their notes from 1 year to the next year to the next year. Even open notes, even small personal loans, was renewed constantly. Besides the mortgages, which was a poor policy. They used to say, the banking examiner would say, well, are you sure he thinks he owes this? You sure he thinks he owes this? Because he's always paying the interest on it. He never pays the principal. Maybe he thinks he doesn't know the principal. Well, when you stop and reason it out, yes. So it took a while. After a period of time, they would have the money. They'd bring their crop money in the fall. Why? And they owed us, say, $300 or $500. I taught them to clean it up, pay it. You can come back next week. We'll loan you this money back. You can have it back, or any part of it. That's what makes for good banking, and that's what we want. They had no objections.
I'm surprised that Ole Bowman, conservative banker that he was. Would have permitted that kind of thing to go on.
His argument was the man is honest. That was his biggest asset. He believed any honest man was entitled to borrow, and of course the bank was loaning money for the sake of interest. That's what they lived off of. And as long as that man was honest and he was good for it, we don't bother him. That was the philosophy. That was the way the banks were run in those days. He was no exception. And yet, you could look at the other side. For the sake of the borrower, it was better to get him out of debt instead of keeping him in debt. That was the different theory, see? That's what I was told by the banking examiners, the banking department, is to put a program and put it into effect because that's good banking. And I agreed with them because I began to believe the same thing myself, is that you pay the interest on this year after year. I wonder, do you know that you owe us $500? You've just been paying the interest all the time. And you stop and think. And then when a depression comes, when hard times come, the recession, and that's when we may want this money, he never has it again, see? And he should pay it up. It helps to make good credit by paying your obligation. That note says that you will pay, I promise to pay on October 1st of so-and-so year, $500, and that's a really, he hadn't been living up to that, see? And those things were all pointed out. I can remember to this day, a Moscow banker was trying to put that into effect, and that was many years after we were having good luck at it, and it was becoming quite a incident throughout the area. That our policy was to make a farmer clean up, no matter if it was only. And the implement houses, the credit concerns, all began to find that out because we would stall them. We would say to the farmer, clean us up. We'll loan your money back, but pay our obligation. They would tell that to these dealers in Moscow and so forth, and the word was getting around. So I can remember that there was a banker in Moscow. He had offended a good farmer, a good financial man, because he wanted to put that into effect, but the borrower resented it under the grounds that, well, I'm good for it. And this banker said, well, read your note. Doesn't it say here, October 1st of 1950, you promised to pay this bank so much money? Yes, well, I'm asking you to make your word good. And there's no argument against it. He felt it. He felt insulted. He came to us. And we told him that was our policy. And he went back and he agreed. He said, yeah, you are right. But he says, we've all lived and banked under a philosophy of this kind until we've renewed, renewed, and renewed. And it is sad.
You know, when we were talking before, I remember you said that Ole Bowman And you too tended to give somebody less than he asked for a lot of the time. That it was, you had a very conservative philosophy of how much a person needed, and Oldie Bowman particularly, instead of a $300 team of horses, would make a man sell for.
Well, of course, he was his philosophy was, if you came in and you wanted to borrow $300 to buy that team of horses, well, he would say, well, you go back to him and offer him $200, say that's all we'll loan you. So he tried to work that. Now that was separate from the fact if a farmer would come in, and I got into the habit of this, and he needed $1,000 to pay his harvest hands, and he didn't have a list. He didn't know. He picked his figure out of the air. See, I knew, that is, I felt that way, that he'd picked his figure of $1,000 because, well, I'm going to ask for plenty, because if I know him, he's going to do me down. See, and I would say to him, well, I'll tell you what. I don't think you need $1,000. Here's $700, or here's $800. You go out, and then if you're short, come back. And it always worked, because there again, you were doing that borrower a favor. That was always what I worked for. I swear that I would, if it had been up to me, every young, poor person wouldn't have ever owed a dime. Yeah, you hated the loan to them because you knew that day was coming, that they had to pay it. And if they didn't have it, if it was a short year, the more they owed, the more sadder it was to collect. So that was my thinking. That was where I got this idea that, well, if you want $1,000 from Rocky, you better start out with $1,200 because he's going to do you down. And that was common.
How well does a banker, I mean, I've often heard it said a banker knows the financial situation of people, of the people in the community extremely well because he's sees their
books.
Would you know person by person,
yes,
the person coming in, how
yes,
kind
yes.
of shape they were
oh,
in?
Yes, yes. After 40 years, after 40, definitely 40 years that I had spent with the Troy people, and I knew all their problems, I knew their matrimonial problems, their marriage problems. Often, I would be taken to the back room and told. And lots of them were minor, but yet, even down so far as I've had farmers come and ask me, what should I sow this year? Well, you didn't know, but you did the best you could. You told them what you would do if you were farming it, because you would follow the things that you felt was good, that could be good for that fall. That is, if barley was scarce the year before, well, plant barley. And of course, you always planted all the wheat you could stand, but wheat was no problem. But whether it be peas or whether it be lentils and those things, well, yes, you get tied right down to where you know their life, and money is awfully, awfully important.
Do you think people could talk to you more easily than, say, a farmer could talk to you about what to plan more easily than he could another farmer?
I think that would be human nature. I think father and son, you could have that, but no, I don't think one farmer would ask another one, what would you plant here? There are exceptions, yes, but as a rule, no. I think they came to me because they wanted me to know, and that was a way to let them know that they confided and they trusted me, or that and they wanted to know that if for me to trust them, and that I would be flattered the fact that they came to me. Yes, that's the purpose of it. It had to have been, because I was raised on a farm. I knew. I had all the qualifications of a farmer, excepting driving a modern tractor, which I never did. But horses and the walking plows and all that machinery, I never had to ask them, what is an Acme Harrow or anything like that. I was way ahead of them. And I knew those things, and I knew how well your ground had to be cultivated, and I knew that a straight bean row didn't make any difference. It was just a little pride within that individual. But if his row was crooked, that didn't make any difference to me. But that's was life in those days.
You think that your own understanding of what kind of advice to give, was it built up from hearing so many? So
oh, yeah.
From knowing what so many different parts of the community had
course,
to tell you?
Yeah, advice, of course, and talking about in generalities, wasn't always advice. You would just talk about if a farmer came in and he wanted to know whether he should hold his wheat or not. That was a dangerous and a touchy subject, because I didn't know. I didn't know any more about whether wheat was going up than the man in the moon. And yet all you could do would be to try to advise him and say, well, I had a father-in-law who was in the grain business. And although he was careful not to be quoted, and he would tell me on the side, he would give me a hint, well, I think barley's going to be good next spring, see. And I learned from that without revealing my hand and saying, but I would encourage sometimes to do that. And of course, I think that rubbed off and it was successful. I had many cattle where we had cattle, and I would try to reason it out. If they had the hay, if they had raised their hay and they had cattle, it was always a poor time to sell cattle in the winter time.
You said they're always higher in the spring?
In the spring, yeah, because you fed an animal all through the winter, and they were become thin, and then you put them out on the grass, and so there was not the flooded market like there is today. Now they have the feedlots, and of course they overcome that. In those days they didn't have feedlots. And of course, your cattle went down in weight during the winter months. And then if you had grass and you kept in good, fairly good shape during the winter, and you turned them out on the grass, they fattened fast, and you made money because the price was always better. Plus the fact that the animal grew, and then if you had a lot of grass, why she became fat, and it paid. And we did fairly well with cattle, better than the grain crops. The grain was hard to gamble. You had to be a wealthy person. In fact, I always feel, and I think today, watching the farmers, that the man that sells 3 weeks after he gets his crop, up to 3 weeks after he gets his crop in a warehouse, is probably the better off. And that was a philosophy that a lot of them did adopt by and went by, that the minute you get your crop in, sell it. You're better off than if you'd gamble, because then you never know when to sell.
Where do you cross over that line from people talking to you about business matters and personal matters?
They ran together.
They just can't separate them apart.
No, there's no way, because you get in a conversation and people, you not only become a part of their life, they become a part of yours. And they depend on you and you depend on them. The only advantage, whether it be advantage or disadvantage, is that you're dealing with hundreds and they deal with one. And of course, I very seldom, after they had left the bank, and that was a philosophy, and I was told and I was warned and I was taught, the minute you leave that bank door, you don't know anybody's business. And that was a philosophy that I followed very, very carefully, because you had to. It had to be that way. Because if you were going to carry your problems and John Jones's problems out on the street, you were in trouble right now, and it had to be that way. And of course, I think that made for more trust and made more for more. People told you a lot more than they would have told anybody else.
But you know, there's this I don't know, maybe it's just a stereotype, I guess, of small town bankers that I've run across in small towns in early days, where the small town banker inspired fear more, perhaps even more than trust. That's what you get in the fiction about small towns, that people were afraid of the power of the banker, and the side of trust and confidence is not usual from what I've the little that I've read in real life, I mean, as it was when in the early days.
Well,
was this unusual, the kind of setup we had?
No, I think that was part of the deal. Now, I can remember also, these are the things that you're told and these are the things you're taught. And I was told, before I left Kendrick, when I came to Troy, they warned me. They said, don't tie yourself up to a family or to a group in your community. In other words, don't harbor a friend, live with him or be chummy. Don't ever get too chummy with anyone, because people will say, well, he tells him everything. See, he's his friend. And that is true. And that's something else that I was warned against, and I did never. I did when I was, before I was married, I ran around with a young boy, a young Fred Spencer, who was a druggist. He was a very honorable kid. And I used to have a heck of a time filing my checks at night, because, and this was before I ever was cashier, I had a lot of responsibility. But I would get the whole week behind, and so help me, and I would take him in after hours, after supper, and he'd go in and he'd help me file these checks. Now, there's where you get history of people. You can you can go through and you're going to file those checks, but if you're not looking for anything and if your mind is a bit miles away, which I did, I posted a machine, I ran a machine, and I never thought what I was doing. It was so mechanical. I filed checks, and unless it was a large one or something unusual, you never looked to see JCPenney, $300. Well, that would be in your mind to say, well, I don't think he can afford that. I don't think he should have bought that. Or, gee, did he pay that much for that damn port? See, if you let those things bother you, you're pretty soon you're talking. And that's what you couldn't do. And, of course, this young man, he respected me, and the fact that I would do that to him, we filed these in the vault, I trusted him. There's where the secret is. If you know that you're trusting somebody and he's trusting you, you have a friendship there that he won't abuse you. And he did. He helped me file these checks, and I know that it never hurt, yet it helped me fantastic. And he was never interested in the banking business. He never followed it and had no desire, but yet he was a real friend and often helped.
Did you find that you had to keep your distance in the early years? I mean, not become over involved, or was that a problem?
No, it was no problem. The younger you were, you were slap happy, and banking, your job was secondary. You never bragged that you were a banker. You weren't any better than anybody else. To me, I never felt that way. I associated with anything. Here I was 20 years old, and I was running around with high school kids when I came to Troy. We associated together because there was nobody my age around here. They had either lived out on the farm or else they had gone away. They had left. And Fred was my age, but he got a job in the drugstore, so he was a natural. But we would, I went with high school girls. In fact, my Marge was already in college at that time. But that's the difference. And you never thought of the fact that, well, I work in a bank. That was no different than the kid that worked in the drugstore. But when you got power, when you became a part of the bank, and then it was a different story. Then you were it. You had weight on your shoulders, and you carried the burdens. Then's when it became a different story. And the deeper you got in, the bigger you got, the longer the list got, then you really had your shoulders. And when I quit up here, I was going to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and quitting anywhere between 5:30 and 6 at night, and oftentimes go back and work. I was doing three man's job, and that's because I had gone into this thing and cultivated it from $300,000 to over $20 million in deposits. I grew with that, and the burdens that was put onto you were so gradual that you were carrying them without any problems. And yes, it's just I've thought of it, and I think I said to Doug Ward many times, he helped me collect on slow loans. And I used to comment, Doug, this doggone thing is just like a barrel that's busting out all over, with the seams are busting. In other words, there's water coming out. You just get one fixed, and over here's another one. And that's life. That's the way it is. And it got too big, see. And that's what happens when you grow from nothing to large, and you're the one that's tied to in the middle here, that it's all the strings are tied to you. And I was carrying too much. That I know. My last 2 years was rough, period. I was working too hard. But the in-between ones was fun. And now when you look back, although I worried, I was always a worrier. I worried for more farmers and people than you can ever imagine. They didn't. Oh, I knew they weren't worrying. I wish they would have. And I was doing their worrying. I knew that was happening. Many, many, many times.
Was this just your nature as a banker?
No, I was serious. I, as a banker, of course, here you've got to understand the workings of credit and of banking departments. We had regulations. We had bank examinations. We had, and I was at the foot of all of that when, if you had a slow piece of paper or you had a paper that was subject to criticism, the examiner asked you about it, you made promises to him. You knew that man so well that you could say to that examiner, he'll pay that this fall. He'll clean up his line. All right, if it was a bad year and it was marginal and he didn't have it, he didn't pay it. He couldn't. You didn't jump on his back. That was no answer. But you had promised that examiner that he was going to pay that. For some unknown reason, he either had a poor crop, the price was right, or he wasn't ready to sell and he should have sold. He had cattle and he should have sold them in July, and here he still had them in September and they had gone down. Those were things beyond your control, yet you had stuck your neck out. Now you worried for him. Not so much the examiner, you worried about yourself is because you made a promise for him and it didn't materialize. What were you to do?
Did you feel that you could give advice that was uncalled for and unasked from farmers?
No,
or did you feel quite reluctant to do that?
Oh, I think that happens, but there were so... I don't think in this area, small town, small farmers, you didn't have that problem. In other words, I think you have that problem more in big business. If you were in an industrial community, now Moscow bankers had far greater problems than I did, because I could never see myself knowing when to turn it off and turn it on in a city of Moscow, because of the fact that we didn't have over 20 merchants in our town, and it was no problem to handle them. You knew their volume, you knew the man, you knew everything about them, and you knew what their future was and how chances of their success was. But in Moscow, where you had maybe 500 or 300 to 500, and you're going to put that same philosophy into effect, it was hard. I thought to myself, what would I do up there? I worry about 20. What would I do with 300? See? And so that's why the credit in a big institution, in a big city, is hard, because you're dealing with one individual. And that one individual, if he can't look after only so many, so consequently, when he's full, he says, "Oh, I don't want any more." See, and they cut you off, and you can't get inside of their door. And that's the problem that I had, what I didn't have in a small town.
But now, you say these men didn't worry very much. You
farmers,
say, you know,
I don't,
didn't worry
Sam,
farming.
I don't say that in generalities. I think any person that's honest, dedicated, and has a desire to make it, will worry. I've always contended they didn't worry enough, or maybe they didn't worry about the right thing, see. I always felt that a man who worried and was concerned was a better credit risk than the happy-go-lucky dependent upon good luck and let the chips fall where they may, because they could fall where they may. And Who was holding the bag? First bank to try.
This is generality too, but you know, I think about how much they knew, how much farmers knew in the earlier days about what was going on. I mean, you were in a position to know what was going on because you were in the banking circles. I mean, what was going on commercially? A longer view, a long-range view, more than year to year. Do you think most of the farmers were...
No.
How were they looking at it?
No, they just lived from one year to the next, and that's all we did. We see big banks, they have people, they have economists, they have... the big chains have their own economists. They can tell you, and they put out publications, and I don't know how many farmers read them or how many people study them. It's just a forecast, and of course... an economist obviously has his place in the world, and naturally, if you know one well enough to trust him, you can probably get some good out of him. But an economist is just like a stockbroker. The worst guy in the world is tell you when a stock's going to go up. He's got them all going up. And they can't all grow up, see? And they used to tell me that, don't you believe in him. He don't know, but he'll tell you, yes, they got to make a front. And that's the same way with an economist. He's got to know his business, and so he's got to predict, because that's what they do. They're predicting people. And I think they're necessary. I don't see anything wrong, but I don't think you can loan a lot of money on the strength of an economist. Mm-hmm. But I think banking, during the farming, when they had the floor, the price supports, to me was far less worry than it is today. Or before they had price supports, and of course they had price supports since 1934, I believe, or 33. And they were kicked out for a short time, but they were put back. Now there are none. And if I were in a bank or was interested in a bank, to me, that's something that should be, I hope, considered. Because it's more fun to know that a man's going to, even though wheat sold for around $1.40, but there was a ceiling of $1.25, that's about the lowest it ever got, or whether the ceiling was 2.5 and wheat was $3, you always knew when you loaned him money, you loaned him on a basis that he was going to get 2.5, because that's the floor. So you could borrow that from the government. That took a lot of pressure off of you. And it took a lot of pressure off the farmer. That's small farmers. Now the big farmer, of course, he doesn't, but a lot of some big farmers don't believe in controls. They never did go for the price support. Because they raised wheat for 50 cents a bushel, and the small farmer, it cost him at least 90 to $1.10 or $1.25 to raise that same bushel of wheat because of the volume, see.
Talking about big and small farmers, in the early days, in the 20s, and when you were first banking, was there a real much of a difference between the poor and well-to-do?
I would say a man that farmed 500 acres was a fabulously big farmer in my day, in my early banking days. A lot of farmers was 160 acres, and that was his livelihood. And he either logged on the side, or he had timber that he was hauling off, he was selling wood, or he was selling hay, and he had a few cattle, and he survived. But of course, the big farmer was the man that had 500 or 300 acres. 300 acres was considered a pretty good size deal. But you had far more problems. His risk, the bigger you got, the greater the risk, even though.
Really?
Yes. Because he had to have better machinery, he had to have more machinery. As a rule, he was gas powered, and his gas bill got pretty high. And I think the fact he was big, he lived a little bit beyond his means in many cases too. He got too big for his britches, in other words.
In those days, what would you consider living beyond your means? I mean, what was luxury in those days?
Of course, so many of them borrowed money with the idea that they were going to pay it back from their crop. And if they anticipated a $5,000 crop and they owed $6,000, somebody was going to be in trouble. And that was what you guarded against. That was a very serious point. As you learned to know a man, and you learned to know how he spent his money. Of course, we did have liquor in those days. We had slot machines in the 40s, and those things were all hazardous to the borrower, you know, because I have loaned. I can remember loaning a farmer $300. On a Saturday afternoon or a Saturday morning, he come in, he said, "I got to pay my hired man." And before night, he was so drunk, they had to haul him home, and the $300 was all gone. He hadn't paid the hired man. Now, that's some of the hazards you had, too. And it actually happened. And it only happened once. It got to where I can remember this, that I never dared go in a tavern myself. They come, Brocky, hide the beer, hide the whiskey. Until It was embarrassing, so I decided it'd be better to stay out, because I knew it. You could tell a look on their faces. And, "Mister, you got no business in here. I don't want you to see me doing this thing." And of course, when you had incidents like that, you told off the guy. I did. I didn't make any bones. The next time he came, I wanted $300. Now, boy, he had to virtually bring the hired man with him and let me pay him, because that's you once was enough, and you learned that, see. But it did happen, and it still happens to this day.
You know, this having to judge, make these judgments, to me it seems like such an incredible responsibility for a person to have to make judgment after judgment and to stand there and make them all day long.
Well, I know, but you see, they can't all be perfect. And getting back to the drinking days, I have actually, and Ole Bowman has too, we have loaned a man that staggered into the bank door. He had to hunt for the latch, he had to hunt for the doorknob, to get in there and get himself up to your counter and say, "Frank, can I have $100? I'll pay you back when I get my paycheck next Saturday." Okay, and you did it. That has actually and literally happened. And I've thought to myself many times that, gee, what chance would he have at a chain bank? But that is true, and he never failed you, because they were honest. They were hard-working Swedes or Norwegians or whatever, and they remembered, no matter what. You say that they couldn't remember, they did. And if he didn't remember, all you had to do was remind him. Say, "Do you remember last Saturday you was in the bank and you got $100? "You bet I did." And if he said, "No, did I do that?" "You sure did. Isn't that your writing?" "By golly, that is." And he would pay it, and that would be the last one. And you did that time after time. You knew who to trust and who not to. But of course there were those that never intended to pay. But they never came. They knew better. They as a rule, the no good alcoholic that never intended to pay, he never bothered the banker. These were exceptions that came to you and staggered into the bank and borrowed $100.
How did you know who you could trust?
Because time and knowing the background, knowing the person, knowing the individual. As I say, if he wouldn't have paid it and he would have forgotten it, or he didn't know what was going on, now you would have said, he would have had the right to say, "Well, my God, if I was that drunk, what'd you loan it to me for? Well, I know you, and I knew that if you didn't get it from us, you would go to somebody else, or you'd go down there, and that's the way you are." Well, that's right, and you drew that conclusion, yes.
I know for myself that you
can bet your bottom dollar, Sam, that Ole Bowman would have never loaned a drunken man $100 if he didn't know that he'd have got the devil for not loaning it to him. See, that it worked both ways. If you wouldn't have loaned it to him and he'd gone down the street, why, he'd have cussed you every step he took if you'd have said no. So, what the heck? And $100 was not a life or death. It was the best advertising you ever did, because they were, I could name you off. I can see them to this day. I can see those particular men that would do that, because they earned hundreds of dollars. They would earn their gross earnings in those days in the lumber camps. They didn't have W-2s in those days, or they didn't have record of their, but they would earn $8,000. Now that was, they would $6,000 and $8,000. That would be their total earnings for the whole year's work. And at the end of that year, if they were laid off on Christmas vacation, they didn't have enough money to buy the mother a Christmas present. Now that's the truth, Sam. That was history. That not only was true in Troy, I learned that it was true in Bowville, that was true in Elk River, that was true in Deary, and obviously Kendrick. Kendrick was not too much of a logging center, so you didn't see so much there. But that's true. They lived strictly from hand to mouth. I would say that after 1960, there was people in Deary and Bowville and Elk River who had a savings account that never had one in their life, because something along the way made them conscious of the fact, well, let's put $50 in savings account. Either either somebody pushed them or somebody started it, or our advertising, which we did. We always advertised savings. We never advertised to make a loan. Our bank advertising, we never advertised. And I used to warn the Moscow papers, if they're for an ad, I said, put anything in there, but don't say, come to us for money. We have them running out our ears. We got more loans than we know what to do with. So, but advertise savings. And anyway, getting back to those individuals, they never had a savings account, and they would start, I would say, around the 1960s. And many of them now, when I left the bank in 73, had $5,000 and $6,000 on savings that never had anything previous to that.
I know in the early days, when Prohibition was on,
yes,
there were many, and part of what caused Prohibition, from
yes,
what I understand, was that you know, women felt that husbands were going off drinking it all
yeah,
up, and
mm-hmm,
if they couldn't get it, then they'd have some
money. Well, it's
just
like the slot machines, yes.
Did you find yourself ever find that women, wives of the family, would try to get you to get their husbands to watch their money? Was that the kind of thing?
No, because I would say that after 1940, the woman came more into power, came more into being. Now, you see, there was such a difference between Bovell and even Deary. Deary was halfway in the middle. Deary had a farming element, and they had the payrolls. But there's a lot of that going on in Deary. But Troy was much different. But there would be lumberjacks who would come home, turn their paycheck over to their wives, and they would get a $20 bill. And of course, $20 would go a long ways when you sat down at a bar in those days. If you had a bonus bartender and he didn't steal it from you, that $20 would last you for 2 or 3 weeks, and you could drink all you wanted every night, because beer was 10 cents a glass, and whiskey was 2 bits for a jigger. And they went a long ways, see. And consequently, the wife often had more problems than the husband. He would be off to work, and she'd be at the bar stool all day long. That happens time and again.
This was in later years, though, right?
Yeah, this was in the 40s, and definitely the 40s, and probably some part in the 50s, and it still goes on, but not as prominent as it was. But I would say that I never, in my occasion, I've had my wives come to me and say, unbeknown to me too, that their husbands were alcoholic, and I didn't know about it. And the reason was the fact that they were away from here. We were financing them, and they were doing business with them. But every time they came here, they were sober, and they didn't even have alcohol on their breath. But I had a lady come to a very prominent person come and say, "I wish you will you tell me what to do to stop, and what should I do?" And I've had that happen, but it had not affected, it had not disrupted their credit, but what it was hurting was the family itself, the animosity between the two. She was getting fed up. But credit-wise, those that drank, we had farmers here that drank up all the cream check, and yet they were substantial, they were good. And yet if you couldn't carry your whiskey and you lost your head, you went bankrupt. So you have both, it was up to the individual whether you wanted to drink your money away or whether you wanted to drink and you were conservative. Half of the money, a lot of your money when you were drinking went, other people took it away from you. You were treating everybody else. You were getting rid of it, see. And there's no problem to get rid of money for some reason or other, especially if you're at a bar. You can pass it around, or you give if you're drunk enough and you give a $20 bill for 3 or 4 glasses of beer and maybe you get about half of it back. That happened. That was common. But and it disappeared, just like the man that borrowed $300 and by night he was broke.
Do you have much of an idea of why drinking was such a problem in the early days, too?
No.
I mean,
of course, I think after Prohibition, they were so anxious to get it that for 2 or 3 years, they it took them a while to catch up. But all during Prohibition, there was beer being made by the gallons. Moonshine was made. I bought moonshine. Shoot, every time you just didn't go to a dance. You had to have something. But the only one advantage was that it didn't take much moonshine to do the trick. You didn't have to buy a fifth. You bought a pint of moonshine, and that lasted you for 3 or 4 weeks and sometimes a month, because you mixed it, of course, and I don't think it took as much. Shoot, I was not a heavy, I never was drunk in my life to the stage that I didn't know what was going on, but you could feel good, and all it would take was maybe one drink. And the guy that got drunk, he was sloppy drunk.
You were saying in that, in what you wrote down there about Kendrick as being in a fairly bad position for the moonshine coming through, it was ignored.
Yes.
That's because it was a farming community?
Farming community, and they were on the way to Lewiston. And Kendrick had dance halls, and they didn't have the lumberjack to contend at all. Well, you got that off. I was going to say that they weren't. Well, I'm not going to say that they were better, but they were a higher class. I have nothing in for the lumberjack. I respect him highly. So, but a farm boy, he was more modest, but they still liked the moonshine, and there was a certain element that always had it, because if you had a bottle, why, pretty soon you were treating your friend, and it made the rounds. But they always, if you bought a pint, you ended up with about a quart or maybe 2 quarts of liquor, of drinkable stuff, because you started mixing it with whatever you wanted to. Ginger ale was very prominent, and of course water was the other way. You couldn't drink real good moonshine straight. It would burn from here down. Oh man, that was terrible.
Well, at the dances,
you always cut it.
At the dances and drinking, would a guy's date drink with him, or just
No, you never, very seldom. I was never around drinking women. I don't know. I've seen them, but I never, no. If I had a drink, my girl very seldom would drink. That was just history. You just had a drink because it was the fad, and you just took one drink and you were off. That's all it took, see. You didn't, if you were unmodest or a good kid or a clean and didn't want to be seen drinking, why, that's all it took. You didn't drink it to get sloppy drunk. That was no fun. There was nothing more disgusting to me than a drunken boy or a man. He was just no good. And I think they all looked at it that way in those days. Just heck fire. Everything was mud in those days, and you had to be sober in order to get around in the first place. And you had to be sober to drive on a muddy road. You just didn't dare go anywhere or any time, and you wanted to be sober. And so I think those that wanted to get drunk got drunk, and those that wanted to drink took a drink, and those that wanted to be sober, and you got along, and you never made an issue about the guy that got too drunk, because pretty soon they were carrying him out. He didn't last long, because the history of the moonshine was so strong that 3 drinks, or he was either under the bed or he was laying out in the gutter. That was just about the truth too. And it was fun to have a drink and go and dance and socialize, because they had fun in those days, so much different than now. Very seldom would you see a high school boy either that would be involved in it, in the drinking. If he was a rounder, as we'd say, he wouldn't be in school. He wasn't much respected. He never had a date, and so consequently, he didn't even come to the dance. It'd be very seldom he'd come. And if you were in high school, I never drank when I was in high school, even to go to a dance. I didn't have one drink, like I was telling you, when I started. If I had any whiskey, it was after I came to Troy. And I was over 20 years old. And
what were the dances like then? That kind of dances you're talking about?
Oh, they were sociable, boy. Yeah, you'd dance with anybody or everybody, and you'd have a good time. And it was really, you weren't wallflowers. There'd be a lot of girls go that wouldn't have dates, and if you didn't had a date, 9 out of 10, you danced. That's all you danced with was your girl. That was the size of it. But you had fun, It was good.
What was the music? What kind of...
It would be a band from either Lewiston or Moscow. Nothing. I think here in Troy, they every schoolhouse would have their dance, and they would have a guitar and a violin and a drum. That was common. But in Kendrick, the dances that was of any consequence held in the halls, they would be put on by a magician in Lewiston. They'd come up to Kendrick and put on the dance, and they'd get somebody to sell the tickets, and that would be it. And they would take all the receipts, and they would pay whatever the hall rent was.
Did dances get rowdy sometimes?
No.
The drinking didn't cause fights?
No, they did, they were outside, and of course then there was law, but nothing like now, but you either got some blooming drunk, you never, there was nobody taken to jail. The only time I can remember anybody got into Kendrick jail was when he would be down there on a Saturday, or he'd come to town drunk, and he'd be in a car, and he'd run up and down the street, and speeding, see? And speeding would be maybe 30 or 40 miles an hour, but he was a hazard, and I can remember they took this guy, he was a dairy guy too, and they locked him up, and they put him in the jail, and thought they'd sober him up, and lo and behold, he took his shirt off and he stuck it under the door of the jail and lit it afire. And man, they carried him out. He was just barely alive from smoke. And beyond that, the jail was right behind the bank. So naturally we get in on anything that happened, but I can't tell you more than a couple times that they ever had anybody locked in that jail. And you never left anybody overnight. And very seldom, because those that drank, either somebody would take them home, or else they would lay down on the, it was always in the summertime, or usually, and they'd sleep it off. But and that was no big issue.
You know, you're talking about this coming into town as a country boy, looking up to the town boys. Was there really a difference that see between the country and the town boys?
Well, that's because you were the town, you were the country boy, and I was scared to death. Shoot, officer, I went to the Kendricks grade school, and the grade school was in the high school building. I took the eighth grade in Kendrick. Oh, and nobody to go with me. I was on my own. George was older, but he didn't start when I did, and I went there. And I don't think anybody went with me. I just walked in the door, and boy, I was a backward anyway, shy. And yes, but that's human. That's the way it is.
You think the country living made young people shy?
Yes, lack of your only kids you know were your neighbors. You played with them, and that was it. See, but you never got acquainted with Kendrick, with town kids, because. When we'd go to town on a Saturday, which was every Saturday, and that's when he got the groceries, and George and I would go with him, and he'd ride in a buggy, if it was in the summer or in the fall or in the spring, the buggy with the wheels, and we would go, and we'd hang on to his coat. We'd never be on our own. We'd never wander off. Well, Dad would get ready to go home. Where's George? Well, he was right here, boy. We were together. We never got away from him. But after you were in town a year or so, then it was a different story. You were one of them. After you got acquainted, sure. But I can remember seeing kids, but you never even looked at them. You were shy.
What did your father do in Kendrick? Was it, what kinds of stuff did he get?
He'd buy the groceries. They bought the groceries once a week. He would buy the... Mother would make bread, but he would buy flour. Or normally, the flour would be bought in the fall. They would buy so many barrels of flour, and that would last. But baking powder, baking soda. If he bought a loaf of bread, bakery bread, that was the same as a cake. That was all eaten on the night, the Saturday evening. Mother would open that bread, and we would eat the slice with nothing on it, and it would just disappear in your stomach, because it was a luxury. But we never buy oranges, never buy bananas. He would get a sack of candy, That was for all of us. That would be a sack maybe that high and a brown bag about that long. That cost 25 cents or 10 cents, I forget which. But that was the treat for the family. But he would have a list probably that long and the groceries, but it would be just a week's deal, coffee. I don't know how often they bought coffee because they bought the beans, the beans rather than the ground. We ground our own. But whatever needed, there was nothing startling.
Did he socialize in Kendrick too?
No, not at all.
He was strictly provisioned.
Strictly, boy, we would go there. You went with a team, and you travel 3 miles with a horse and buggy. It took us an hour to get to town, and it took us another hour to come home. It was downhill. You didn't run your horses downhill, never. He would never run a horse downhill. And coming uphill, they're just a slow gait. So, and the days was short. He was always home by 5 o'clock because he'd get his chores. He was very prompt. He was never, I had an uncle, you know. that was my mother's half-brother. He used to go to town and he'd be home maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And he'd be driving that team up Brady Gulch in the pitch dark. Oh, it used to worry my mother and she'd get so disgusted with him. My dad was the other way. Get home before dark. We've got to get home before dark. We've got to get the chores done before dark. He never wanted a lantern any more than he had to in a barn doing work after hours. So, and normally Dad, unless it was a big day and he had something special, he'd go to town after dinner, which would be 1 o'clock. He'd get to town by 2. By 3, he has his deal done. He visited a lot. That's when he would... Granddad, for instance, took care of the Masonic Temple down there. He was a great lodge man, and we'd go up. He'd take Dad up, and we would pass his place on the way, and often he'd go downtown with us, and then he'd go up in the temple and sweep or do. And when we get ready to go home, my Dad'd go up and us kids, and we'd get Grandpa and bring him down, put him in, and he'd be through with his job. Or if he wasn't quite through, Dad'd wait and. And so then by 3 o'clock we were on the road home. So it would be after four before we got home. But that's the way it was, and that was no different. And I can remember he traded, and of course the store owners got to know us by George and Frank. Got those two boys with you until they were just a part of him, and we were a part, and he was a part of us. And we were just quiet kids that was just as curious as anybody. But Dad moved, we got scared, where's Dad? And boy, you just didn't get out of his sight. That's the way we were born and raised and lived under those conditions until, and he died early in life. And then we were on our own. But...
what you say in there, it's clear to me that your father's death was very hard on your mother.
Oh, sad. Yeah, they were a very devoted couple. And that young, you know, it was tragic, yes. And 5 kids. And the oldest one was 1990, was 15 years old. And I was 12. Margaret was 10, and Wally was 8, and Kenny was just he didn't even remember his dad. But it was sad, yes. Yes. And she brooded over it. Because that first summer, I can remember when things didn't go right, or when she went, obviously, different times, you know, the months, menstruating and so forth, that's when they get low. But that, to me, I didn't even know this, but she would get discouraged, and she would. I would find her in the bedroom crying on the bed, laying across the bed, crying, sobbing. And brother, did that hit me. And I would just run and grab her and get right in her arms. And I was a grown kid. I was 12, 13 years old. Imagine. No, you wouldn't do that normally. But I would try to pacify her and try to talk her out of it, see. And talked to her, and it worked. It wasn't a matter of just time, because she felt that, well, I can't do this in front of him. And I was the only one of the works that did it. The rest of them, when she would get those spells, they would all run in the opposite direction, stay out of the way. They didn't know what it meant, or I guess. But anyway, it was apparently a terrific lesson to me. What it is like, what death is like, and what sadness it can bring to us young family.
Afterwards, after your father died, did your mother just keep on going the way she had been, do the same thing she'd done before? Did much change for her?
Oh, I think she became more religious in her own way. She never pushed it onto us. But she read the Bible a lot, but her life, we were her life. In other words, George and I, she got enough insurance from Dad's death. She paid off the farm, and we had a pretty good crop that fall. He died in January, and we harvested the crop that fall. And she had a pretty good crop, and she paid the mortgage off on the land. And she had some money left, and the following year, we talked her into starting a cafe in Kendrick. That was the disappointment of our life. I was too young, and George was, after it was going, he didn't own any part of it, and so we started it in, I would say, about July or August, and I believe it was either November or December, it caught fire. I wasn't even there. He had been there, and he had turned on the stove. It was a gas stove to heat some water for coffee. I don't know whether it was around 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know whether he fell asleep or what happened. But anyway, he forgot it. And when he went back to look at it, it was in the back end, and it was all aflame. So it burned out. Well, we got insurance, but I think Mother, before we threw on Mother, she had taken about a $2,000 loss, and that was fantastic in those days. But that was number one experience, and I look back and I see that that was a lesson to me. I never forgot that either, because I had many opportunities to finance operations like this from time to time, and I would say, young people, see. And it would get after him.
This is going to be Laura, my wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, come on in.